It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we explore some of the most interesting place names from around the state.
First, the Wisconsin Assembly worked late into the evening Thursday, the last day of the current session for them. After a 13-hour day, a flurry of bills was considered. Many were passed.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joins us now to help break down the big day on the Assembly floor. Sean, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
So, were you up late last night? How late did they go?
Yeah, they went until a little after midnight. Thankfully, our colleague Laurel White was writing the stories for those late bills. But, you know, they always go late on that last night, and yesterday was no exception.
And it seems that there were kind of two themes that emerged in the bills that passed last night. One was water and the other local control. Let's start with the water aspect first. Can you unpack the water issues that were coming up?
You had a few bills. I mean, it is hard to kind of summarize what happened this week because there was so much and it covered so many different topics, but you did have a few bills that dealt with water. And one, which seemed like it was going to be a pretty big bill dealing with landowner rights along lakes, would have given landowners significantly more rights to dredge along those lakes. They would have gotten a general permit instead of an individual permit where they have to go through a DNR scientist. It can be a lengthy process. Would have made it much easier to dredge lakes. That passed the Assembly. Got scaled way back in the Senate. The dredging stuff was taken out, and so the Assembly agreed with the Senate last night, sent it to the governor's desk.
So it's the same bill, except something's taken out.
There's still plenty in that bill dealing with wetlands. It's still a big bill, but some of the most contentious stuff, the controversial stuff with dredging, with redefining who owns some lake beds from the public to private ownership, that's gone. And so the stripped-out bill is now headed to the governor's desk.
And there was also a bill that looked to privatize water utilities in the state, and that one failed. What happened there?
It's highly unusual to see a bill come to the Senate floor or the Assembly floor beyond the calendar and not pass. Really unusual. It's happened a few times this session, but typically when Republicans say we're going to do this, they do it. They did not on that water utilities bill. And that is one that just sailed through the Assembly earlier this year. People didn't really give it a second look. Then Flint, Michigan happened. People start giving public water utilities a lot more scrutiny. They look at this bill and they see this gives makes it much easier to sell a public water utility, makes it hard for the public to block that through a referendum, opens it up to out-of-state utilities. And there were some senators who had issues with that, particularly just, you know, taking the public voice away with the mandatory referendum was an issue for some of them. So Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald took it off the calendar Tuesday night, said that's dead for this year.
Interesting. So it really seems like it's when it came up and what was going on in kind of the larger context that might have affected it.
I think the circumstances there, and one of those where the more you learn about a bill, the more questions get raised.
So there's another water issue. That one involves high-capacity wells and the bill surrounding that. So I understand there was a little bit of a surprising vote there, too. What happened with that?
Yeah, it'll take me a second to set this up, I think. But basically, the bill that passed the Assembly last night would let people who already have well permits rebuild their wells, build a new well within 75 feet of the old one, repair their wells without getting a new permit. It would also let them transfer their existing permits to another landowner. So you sell your property or you pass it down generations, that permit would be passed on in perpetuity. It's a really big deal in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin because farmers there rely on these wells to grow their crops, and people who live there are seeing lakes and streams drying up. So hugely contentious issue for the legislators who represent that issue, that area, excuse me. We'll hear from a couple of them right now. First is Representative Scott Krug, a Republican. He's been working on the high capacity wells issue for a few years now, been looking for a compromise bill that would kind of have a give and take from all parties involved. And what he did was he offered this this plan, this amendment that would do the stuff that I just mentioned with grandfathering in the old wells, but also call for a study of a number of watersheds in his area. And he rattled those off on the Assembly floor as he talked about why that's a good thing last night.
I've been to Morrow Lake, and there are problems. I've been to Long Lake, and there are problems. I've been to Plainfield Lake, and there are problems. You know, I live by Lake Arrowhead. I live by Lake Camel. I live by Lake Peatonwall. I live by the Wisconsin River. I live by Lake Sherwood. There's problems. They're all in the study.
So he's saying that we're going to study this. We're going to come back with data on, you know, what's really happening here, and that that's better than doing nothing. Democrat Katrina Shankland, who represents an adjacent assembly district, got up on the assembly floor and said, look, do we really need more studies? And here she is.
This bill isn't actually about studies. This bill is about water rights. And what I hear from my colleagues on this side of the aisle is they're finally choosing science, but they're using it to hide behind their bogus reasons for giving some people water rights and taking water away from other people. Mr. Speaker, we don't need to study a lake that's already dry.
Okay, so now that vote, it passed, as expected. Representative Krug, though, he offered that amendment. He got it out of committee, so it wouldn't be on the assembly floor if he hadn't got it there. But then he voted against it on the assembly floor. Why? You know, it is a hugely contentious issue in his district. He represents a swing district, basically a 50-50 district. And so he's trying to walk a political tightrope on that
one. Hedging his bets a little
bit.
We're talking with Sean Johnson. He's WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. We're recapping the marathon assembly session yesterday and what bills came up and were passed. So there were a lot of other bills, but a couple of the bills that you focused in on after yesterday's session was around the issue of local control, it seems. There also seem to be some specific targets, one a county executive and one the Milwaukee Streetcar Project. Tell us about the streetcar project first. What's going on there?
The streetcar project is the Milwaukee streetcar project, the big priority of Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett. He says that that could be used to spur economic development downtown. Republicans have, I think you have to say, they've mocked the proposal. They call it a trolley. They say there's no evidence that's going to, you know, lead to any development, and it's a waste of money. So what they did last night, they didn't completely block the streetcar. They can't do that. The streetcar could still be built with city money and federal money, and has received federal money. But what they did is they passed a bill that said it can't receive state money, and it can't receive money from Milwaukee County either. So that's a case where a lot of Milwaukee Democrats were saying, well, why don't you just leave us alone? Republicans are saying, we are. It's just you're not going to get any state money for this.
And the other is interesting. It's about whether someone can hold two public offices at the same time or not. Tell us about that situation and what the decision was.
Yeah, this is definitely an issue that, again, it would apply to everybody, but this is really geared at the Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris, who is running for the state Senate district up there that's going to be an open seat as a Democrat, probably the best chance for a pickup for Democrats this year, you know, widely viewed as the most competitive Senate seat that we're going to see this fall. So what it would do is it would say if Mark Harris wins, he has to give up the county executive job, that a county executive cannot serve concurrently as a state legislator. So, you know, had he wanted to finish out his term as county executive or serve as both while he's in office, that option would be off the table for him under the bill that is now headed to the governor's desk.
It seems interesting because it's basically telling the voters that they can't have that person serving them in two ways.
Yeah, that's his argument, Harris's argument. And what Democrats said is that if the voters don't like this, they could vote him out of office. But they put him there. If they elect him as state senator, they know what they're getting.
And this is, it's also important to note, I think, that this is not a full-time legislature.
Well, it is. It is. But
they're not in session.
No. I mean, I think they're considered a full-time legislature, but the assembly finished up last night. It's mid-February. They have other duties as state legislators. But from here until, you know, the end of 2016, in theory, they're not coming back for a session day.
So one interesting bill that had strong feelings on both sides was one to expand strip searches. What happens next with that bill and what would it allow?
What it would allow, it would basically undo a bill, a law that they got passed last year, which says that there has to be a 12-hour waiting period when you're detained before police can conduct a strip search. Police didn't like that because they said what ends up happening is you have people that either we have to, you know, set aside in basically solitary confinement for 12 hours so that they don't hurt anybody that's, you know, a guard or another inmate, or we let them in without strip searching them and, you know, they're potentially dangerous. This is one where, and it's an individual liberties issue. And people who didn't like this bill were saying you could have somebody who committed a nonviolent crime, not necessarily even guilty of that crime, go in, be detained, and have to squat naked in a jailhouse floor because of this law.
Mm-hmm. And is that one, if it does end up going all the way and Governor Walker signing it seems like there might be some constitutional challenges to that.
It could be, you know, I think anything time you're dealing with issues like that, you could see a constitutional challenge if there was somebody who wanted to represent an inmate in those cases. I don't know. I think it would mirror a lot of what they're doing or what they had been doing until a law that was passed last year.
And just to wrap up, Sean, the Senate is going to have their final session in March. A lot of these bills will be going to the Senate. Any expectations that they would go a different way than the Assembly?
There's a lot of big question marks out there still. Or, you know, for example, we haven't talked about it, but the governor's higher ed package that he listed as really a top priority for him in his State of the State address. The Assembly passed that. The Senate said, you know, we might want to scale that back a little bit. If they do that, if they don't pass the same version as the Assembly, that bill dies. So there's a little bit of drama yet in March.
Sean, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief and covered yesterday's wrap-up session in the Assembly. We have a link to Sean's article on the bills passed last night, and you can find that on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
For taking a trip all over the state to talk about some of the most unique and hardest to pronounce place names in Wisconsin.
From Oconomowoc to Waukesha, Ryo to Boscobel, Wisconsin is home to a number of places that can make residents and outsiders stop and scratch their heads.
Here's just a taste of that from a few years ago when the Packers were in the Super Bowl. Good times. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Mike DeSisti had people in Texas try to pronounce names of our Wisconsin cities and towns.
Waukesha. Waukesha.
Waukesha. Waukesha.
Menomonee Falls.
Mukwanago.
Kakuna. Kayakuna. Kayakuna.
I don't know. I like some of those variations. Well, for help on those names and many others, we're joined by Jackie Johnson, also known as Miss Pronouncer. She's a former political reporter and founder of the website MissPronouncer.com. Jackie, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. So there's a quote about the name Wisconsin that may explain why there are so many unique names found around the state. What is that?
Well, this is according to the Wisconsin Historical Society. Wisconsin is actually the English spelling of a French version of a Miami Indian name for the river that runs about 430 miles through the center of our state.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, now I'll try to recite that back to me.
Well, and so you've got the website, MissPronouncer.com. I'll say we in the radio world thank you profusely for this thing. We go to it a lot for not just
thank
the place
you.
Names, but for the people
Absolutely.
Names, too. So what led you to create MissPronouncer?
So this started a while ago when I was, you know, I just said so at the beginning of a sentence. I told myself not to do that. This started long ago when I was doing morning radio, and there's not many people at the radio station at that time. So when I'm putting together copy, you know, for news reading and anchoring, there's nobody there who I can consult with if I need to know how to pronounce a name of something or other. And you can't exactly call a source at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. So I started putting together this list of names and other things I thought would be needed in the future. And I put it together for myself, actually. And at the same time, simultaneously, I was messing around with HTML. That's when it was all brand new. And then I ended up putting it together on a website, and it ended up being useful for many other people aside from just myself.
Okay, Jackie, we're going to put you on the spot. Do you have a favorite name of a place in Wisconsin?
I do. And, you know, I have to think about this one, but I've said it so many times. I think I've got it down. Nanawia Omanahican.
Wow. Where is that?
This one is kind of on the border of Menominee and Shawnee counties. It's in the Menominee reservation. It's right between two other cities, which are kind of hard to pronounce. It's right between Neopit and Kashina.
And there's also Shawano, which if you read it phonetically, you would say Shawano.
Right.
And this is a nuisance maybe for people who's moving here. It's a job hazard for people in the media. And, you know, we've got some new staffers here from out of state. Or even if you're just, you know, from one part of Wisconsin and you're not familiar with the other part, this is something that can really trip people up, isn't it?
It really can. And, you know, the thing is, with a lot of things in life, if you take an educated guess, you can sort of come up with the right answer, probably a big majority of the time. But sometimes an educated guess is not good enough. There's a little place called Gotham. And what was deceiving about it is there used to be a bar there called the Bat Cave. The Bat Cave was located in Gotham. So most people just assumed it was Gotham, but it's not.
Well, and that goes along with Rio and New Berlin, not how you would expect them to be said either.
Another good one is Levis. It looks like the pair of jeans, Levi's, but it's actually Levis in central Clark County.
I have to say, when you said the educated guess idea, I was actually pretty proud of myself when I moved to Madison because I thought I'd figured out that there's the stress is usually on a particular syllable with the Native American names. And so for a few years, I said Mazamani because it looked like it should be, but no, it's Mazamani.
Yeah.
Right, and there are just so many of them. You know, Rio is one which only contains three letters in that word, but it's often mispronounced, especially by newbies to the state.
We're talking to Jackie Johnson, mispronouncer, about Wisconsin's fascinating place names and differences, problems with pronouncing them. And now part of the problem, Jackie, is not everybody agrees on a city like in southeastern Wisconsin, Racine or Racine, and people argue that on either side, right?
Right. It's really interesting. And my sister was even telling me that she hears on the news yet a third pronunciation, which is, you know, really difficult for me to believe. What was she saying? Oh, geez, I don't even remember. But it's just so so hard to believe.
We could go with the French and say Racine, Racine, which would mean rooted. So there you go. I'm just throwing that out there. So Wisconsin not only has a lot of cities and towns, but there are also a lot of unincorporated areas. How in the world did you go about finding the correct pronunciation for all of these places?
Oh, man, it was a lot of work. And I originally put the cities, towns, villages, and various other things, as you mentioned earlier, lawmakers. And the unincorporated, you know, it was on my to-do list, and I never really got around to it until the state cartographer's office made a map locating all the unincorporated places after doing a lot of thorough research. And they had the map, and then they came to me, and I thought, well, this is the kick in the pants I needed. So then I got the audio to incorporate into their map, and I called around. There were some places that I just knew, considering I lived in the state my whole life, but those I didn't know, I called, you know, librarians, county clerks, local businesses, or just, you know, people I saw walking down the street. I tried to talk to as many people as I can to get at least a couple of different people pronouncing the name so that I had some sort of consensus.
We'll bring on a caller. Reed is with us in Clintonville. That's an easy to pronounce one. Reed, hi. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. I wasn't sure what I just sort of, I tuned you in, and I just sort of got a little hint of something there about, she said, between Neopit and Kashina, and I wasn't sure if Ms. Johnson was trying to say Manasakia.
Manasakia is how you say it, Reed, and this is what I can't evaluate.
There's Middle Village there between the two. I didn't hear all of what she had said.
Gotcha, Reed. And that was when I think you said, Jack, you were a little, you were just trying to lock this one down. Manasakia, did you say Manasakia?
No, that I did not say that, but it's interesting that he mentioned Middle Village because what I said, Nanawia Omanahican, is actually the original name for Middle Village. They renamed it, you know, so it's easier to pronounce.
You know, the one that throws me always should be easy, but I have to stop and think, Oregon. And now I cannot in a flow, if I think about it, I know it's Oregon, the state, Oregon, Wisconsin, and I can't do it without stopping and thinking about it. Are there any little ones that trip you like that?
Well,
you like
I was going to say, it's like, you know, we're siblings from another mother or something, because I also pause every time I say that, because the state, again, Oregon, and yeah. the city just south of Madison is Oregon.
Right. And so you do people names as well, and they can be very tough to pronounce in Wisconsin. Here's a piece from the Wisconsin Radio Network when President Obama was trying to introduce a former Madison mayor.
I especially want to thank our host this evening, the mayor of Madison, your own Mayor Dave, who endorsed me here today. Thank you, Mayor Dave Chesilowski. We've got two wonderful mayors in the house. First of all, your own Dave Cheslovich is here.
So there are two variations on yeah. Cheslovich there. I, being half Polish, have a pretty good lock on those names. But it must be tough because there's a constant turnover of politicians.
Right, and you would think he'd be informed, you know, by his handlers. They would come to town, and maybe he was, but he just can't remember all of these names. I was also looking, it was just a couple of years ago, that he was in Waukesha, and he said, Waukesha. And I don't even know how that plays into it. And then he was also thanking, at the time, there were many dignitaries there, and he thanked Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley.
All right, we'll leave it there. Jackie Johnson, thanks to her, founder of mispronouncer.com. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert. We're in the midst of winter, which can mean heavy meals, comfort food, root vegetable dishes, beef stews. But our next guest says one way to brighten winter menus is to add citrus. The fruit is grown in warmer climates, and it's generally at its peak in our winter months.
We've tasked Food Friday regular Lori Skelton with testing how we can use citrus to brighten up our winter menus. And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you do this? What's your favorite way to get some citrus, some zest into your meals? What questions do you have about cooking with citrus? And what's your favorite recipe using the lemons, limes, oranges, grapefruits, and more for the winter? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post, find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton is one of WPR's in-house foodies, and she's with us in the studio right now. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the inspiration behind this segment. Why did you decide to pursue using citrus in winter cooking?
I was given a cookbook solely on citrus last summer and was told by several people, save it for winter because that's when all of the really interesting fruit actually makes it into Wisconsin. And then I did spend Christmas into New Year's in Florida, so I had a chance to practice on some very fresh fruit down there, then come back and find out what was waiting for me here in Wisconsin. I was very surprised to find out that almost everything in this citrus cookbook, which was written in California, can be found here in Wisconsin, and not just in specialty markets. Some of the winter fruits that they talk about are starting to show up more and more at your corner grocer. Great.
Now, there's a lot of talk, of course, about locally sourced foods. This is not going to be one of them in Wisconsin, summer, spring, whatever season. But this can be a good time of year to find a lot of kinds of citrus in our stores.
And it's also a good time of year to use citrus in long-term do-it-yourself projects. There are a number of ways of preserving citrus for later use, as simple as pureeing kumquats and freezing the puree. That will keep in the refrigerator, in the freezer, for about 6 months. But there's also things like making preserved lemons or preserved limes, making your own limoncello or citrus salts or candied peels. And those can take time. And it's a great project for if you have, say, you're snowed in with the kids and you want something to do, get them in the kitchen and start making things that you can use months ahead with citrus.
So citrus is significant this time of year for people who celebrate the Chinese New Year. What's the connection there?
Certain citrus fruits are considered good luck at Chinese New Year. The Chinese word for orange and gold are very, very similar. The Chinese words for tangerine and luck are very similar. And the pomelo version of grapefruit has a similar sound to the Chinese words for prosperity and status. So all three of those fruits are considered lucky at Chinese New Year. Hmm. So, again, perfect timing. It's a winter fruit, and yet it. So here we go. We've got something to celebrate. If not local, it's certainly seasonal if you're celebrating Chinese New Year.
When I think of using citrus, I'll put lime on, you know, Mexican style food, chicken taco or something like that. I'll just eat a piece of citrus or mix it into a fresh citrus vodka gimlet. When you put the word out to see, hey, what do you do with citrus and cooking? What kind of things were people talking about?
A lot of people were talking about slicing up oranges or grapefruit and adding them to salads to brighten up winter salads. Grapefruit is a really good thing to pair with fennel. Also, some bitter greens. If you've got some really bitter spinach at this time of year, you want to wake it up. Orange, lemon, grapefruit, great thing to throw in that salad. It's also a good thing to pair with avocado. Citrus does seem to like things that have a little bit of fat to them. And then there are the wonderful ideas for anything orange beef. The standard is Chinese takeout, but I know several people have mentioned they make beef stews and add a little bit of orange juice and a lot of grated orange zest. Mm. There was a recipe in the Citrus Cookbook for osso buco, a very hearty beef stew with orange gremolata, a way to really brighten up citrus zest. There were also recipes in here for pork and citrus. I've done that with oranges before. This was the first time I tried pork stuff with grapefruit and fennel. I think that worked better as a salad, but the idea of starting to use more citrus with heartier meats. I think we always think about chicken. We always think about fish. But beef, pork, there are some definite ways you can use citrus, especially at this time of year, to, again, lighten the way the food tastes.
Well, and you talked earlier about pairing citrus and fennel, fennel bulb, for people who haven't used it before. And actually, you just mentioned meat. You did a pork loin that was stuffed with grapefruit and fennel. And how did that all come together?
That was one of the recipes in this book. I thought, in hindsight, it probably worked better as a cold salad. What I would do with pork is incorporate some kind of citrus, either lemon or lime or orange, into a mustard sauce. Mm-hmm. Again, that's a standard we expect on our table with pork. You throw in the citrus, it suddenly makes it brighter, makes the whole dish taste lighter.
And also tenderizes the meat a little bit as well.
Just a little, yeah.
It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us talking about integrating citrus into our winter cooking. And let's get to the recipe you have on the Central Time Facebook page, Lori. You did a couple cakes, and thank you for that, by the way. They're both really good. The one we've got, let's start with the one on the Facebook page. Beautiful. Just to look at this thing, it was amazing. A blood orange upside down cake.
Which I have to throw out there. Blood oranges are my absolute favorite.
Oh, citrus. I like them. They're just so cool looking, too.
Why do you prefer a blood orange over your standard navel?
It's a more complex flavor. It's not quite so simply sweet. There's a sweetness, but it's not. That's not the first thing you and I have to say, visually, it's just stunning.
It is.
You feel like a vampire when you're eating it.
Yes, there's something, there's almost a berry quality to a blood orange, and they're showing up again more and more in Wisconsin. Oddly enough, the blood oranges that have the most flavor are the kind we don't always get in America, because the ones that have the most flavor, check my notes here, Tarocco. It's an Italian orange, but they don't have the, for want of a better word, the red color bleeding onto the skin. Moro oranges do, and those are the kind you tend to see more in America. So if you see something that's marked blood orange and it doesn't look any redder, chances are you've got the better tasting orange, so grab it. To get back to this recipe, this was a very easy upside down cake. Rather than having to make a heavy caramel to stick your slices of blood orange on, this was just very simply melt some butter, throw in some brown sugar, throw in a little bit of citrus juice, put that in the bottom of your cake pan, slice your oranges so it looks like either jewels or, as one of my friends said, a crinoid fossil, and then you put a batter on top of that. I ran across a number of recipes for orange upside down cakes. I like this particular one from the New York Times because it used more cornmeal than it used flour. Twice as much finely ground cornmeal as flour. And I thought the texture of this was just amazing. And I think for the most part, when I brought the two orange cakes in, I'd say 80% of the people who tried it here preferred the orange upside down cake.
So I'm looking at the picture on the cover of the Citrus Cookbook that you use, sweet and savory sun-kissed recipes, and it looks like the rind is on the blood oranges there.
In this particular recipe, in the Citrus Cookbook, they are. I think it tastes a little bit better in an upside down cake when you don't have the rind, because of course with the rind you've got lovely oil on the very surface, but then bitter pith underneath.
That's what I was wondering about.
And that was the component in the second orange cake I brought. This was a gluten-free cake. It was half ground almonds, half sugar, 6 eggs, and then 2 whole oranges that had been simmered in a pot of water for 2 hours and then thrown in the food processor, peel, pith, and all, and pureed. Simmering them did take out some of the bitterness from the pith, but not entirely, and there was a bitter aftertaste that some people just didn't like in that cake.
You know, for an easy method of getting a citrusy flavor into, say, a white or yellow cake, I mean, could we just, you know, randomly add a little bit of orange zest or lemon zest into it, or is that really just going to get buried?
If you're working just with zest in a plain cake, that's a good way to start, but I think if you're talking a plain cake, you will probably need to add some juice or zest to your frostings, how you ice the cake, or you have the option of making citrus curd, which is very popular for cakes in Britain, where you gently simmer your citrus juice, your citrus zest with a little bit of butter. You can either do it over a pot of boiling water, or if you're a really good cook, you just do it over a low flame. Whisk, whisk, whisk until it gets thick, and then you serve that curd on the cake. I made a tangerine curd and brought this in for people to try on scones. I had no idea you could cook with tangerines. I just assume tangerines, you know, it's easy to eat. You just eat it out of hand. This made the most delicate, floral, lovely curd that went on top of those scones. Huge hit with the Wisconsin Public Radio staff.
And we can try some deep-fried tangerine curd next, being in Wisconsin. We're talking to Food Friday.
With ranch dressing.
Exactly. You. Food Friday regular Lori Skelton is with us to talk about brightening up our winter menus with citrus.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions about incorporating citrus into your winter meals? What's your favorite way to use citrus in your cooking or your baking? And what flavors do you typically pair with citrus in your cooking? Join us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about using citrus in our winter cooking.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your advice, recipes, and questions. Do you cook with the lemons, limes, oranges? Grapefruit. Yuck. I don't like grapefruit, but you can tell us about it anyway. Do you have a question about how to do that in a savory dish, in a sweet dish? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Ron is with us in Menominee. Ron, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Ron?
Well, when I'm cooking, I make a lot of banana breads, but and I use a blood orange liqueur named Salerno. It's Italian. It's a very, very bright flavor, and a little bit goes a long ways. But although it brings a lot of orange flavor to whatever you add it to, there's a tiny bit of bitterness in the background, but it's really nice. It can bring a very, very that very bright, rich orange flavor to. I've also used it a couple of times in cakes, and it works very, very well.
And just a sprinkle a tiny bit in banana bread, and that makes a big difference.
Well, I'll do a banana bread with a glaze when I finish, kind of like a glazed donut.
Mm-hmm. Ron, thanks a lot for that. So the idea, you mostly worked with, exclusively worked with fresh citrus here, Lori, but this idea of using a citrusy liqueur.
Oh, like I'd really have a problem using liqueurs. And that sounds absolutely amazing. And I know there is another Italian blood orange because it's not available in this country. I think it comes from Seville, up north near Venice. Mm. And so that's probably what this particular liqueur is. No, there are always ways to infuse vodka or something with citrus, and if you've already got the liqueur, well, I know it's sort of going against the grain, but as good as a lime margarita is, there's something about a blood orange margarita with Cointreau that is just out of this world.
I had one of those not that long ago.
Oh, yeah.
Really quite tasty. So I want to talk about kumquats, not just because it's a fun word, but tell us about kumquats.
Now, I was very surprised. I've only started seeing them in Wisconsin in just the last few years. They're about the size of the first joint of your thumb. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit fiddly to work with. Most recipes will ask that you cut them in half and take the seeds out. The seeds are kind of big, but you don't need to peel a kumquat. Mm-hmm. It's going to give you fiber as well as some great antioxidants. Again, you can keep them in the fridge for 3 weeks. If you puree them, the puree will hold in the freezer for 6 months. This has a more earthy citrus taste. It's not as bright as some of the other things we've been talking about. But if you lightly cook this down with some spices and something a little sweeter, this is amazing. Either for something like pancakes or waffles to top it with, or if you go a little bit savory, kumquats are amazing on top of roasted meats. We made a chili ginger sauce with kumquats and served it on top of roast duck. It was amazingly good.
Now, does the kumquat simmer in that scenario, or is this just fresh mixed in with the stuff?
This was simmered for about 20 minutes, half an hour. You don't need to cook them too terribly long, but kumquats with ginger just paired beautifully. And then something very, very easy to do with a kumquat is throw about a dozen of them in your food processor with a stick of softened butter and a tablespoon of honey. And blitz that up. And again, this is something great for breakfast on top of toast or bagels or waffles.
Great.
And this also will keep for a long time. A great way to use up your kumquats if you can find them. And you can start finding them more and more often.
Let's go to the phones again. And Judy in Grand Marsh is with us. Hi, Judy.
Hello.
Hi.
This is a really good way to use the actual good-tasting part of the skin of a tangerine or a blood orange or anything like that. If you peel them like you normally would and get the fruit out and lay it the orange side or whatever color the skin is flat, have your hands very well cleaned and use a good nail brush. And if you have a good thumbnail, it is the most fun thing for a person suffering from cabin fever to scrape that piss off with your... It gets addictive. It really does. And you're left with only the orange. And once I always wash the fruit before I start this process, and you can dry it or whatever. And because it's so thin, you can't use it on a grater or anything. So I cut it with the scissors. Just cut it finely. It's delicious. And it's an addictive habit that I wouldn't spread around, to the general public that I actually enjoy doing. But it's lots of fun.
Will be our secret, Judy. Thanks for that. And then, you could use that fresh, but that seems like something you could, it wouldn't be pickling exactly, but preserve candy, I guess, Laura?
Candied peel is a lovely way to preserve it. Have you seen ever in a store something that looks like a small yellow octopus with maybe a dozen tentacles? That's called a Buddha's hand or citron. And what you can do with that is you don't even need to peel that. You can go ahead and cut it into quarter size pieces, parboil it for about 30 minutes, and that will take some of the bitterness out. And then go ahead and candy that with a simple syrup. If you've ever had real candied citron in a fruitcake, you will never go back to that hard, neon jeweled stuff again. Candied citron is wonderful, and you can use the same idea with citrus peels. With most citrus peels, you don't even need to parboil them to get that bitterness out. Just go ahead, put them in with simple syrup. Let that cook for...
Simple syrup just being sugar and water.
Sugar and water in equal parts. And let it cook for half an hour. Take the candied peel out. Let them dry until it's not totally dry, still a little bit tacky. Then roll them in sugar. And then hang on to the syrup, because that, again, is wonderful putting in your cocktails.
Let's go back to the savory side a little bit. So let's move on to limes. You made a Caribbean-inspired lime coconut chicken curry for the WPR staff. How did it turn out?
I had a couple of questions about the way this particular recipe was set up. And when I do it again, I will make some changes. This particular recipe called for bone-in, skin-on chicken thighs, which you would marinate in lime juice, sweet curry powder, and medium hot chili powder for about 12 hours. Then sear the chicken and throw it in a crock pot with coconut oil, coconut milk, and shredded unsweetened coconut. I thought it came out a little too oily, so next time I will use boneless, skinless chicken thighs. I won't put nearly as much oil in the marinade. I won't put nearly as much oil in the pot to sear them. I may not even sear them the next time. They may go straight from the marinade into the crock pot with the coconut. That said, once we got past the, well, I'm not so fond of the oiliness, I'm not so fond of the texture of the skin, everybody thought it tasted amazing. This is the first time I've ever done a Caribbean type of curry, and I will definitely keep that in the repertoire.
All right, a lot of good ideas for experimentation here, and that upside-down cake, the blood orange upside-down cake recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Lori, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
That's Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies here at WPR. She was with us to talk about how to use various kinds of citrus fruit to brighten up our winter recipes. It's a warm day here in Wisconsin. I'm wearing a short sleeve shirt, warm by February standards anyway, but we're not out of the woods quite yet. There's more winter to go. So a few more weeks of feeling, you know, that winter blah, the low energy, we're dreary, we're foggy minded because of the cold, right? Maybe not, according to some recent research.
CNN reports on two new studies that challenge what we might think about winter. One suggests that winter weather and shorter days may not make us more likely to be more depressed than other times of the year. And another study measures our mental sharpness in a variety of tasks and finds that our brains work just as well in the winter as the rest of the year. And they may even use less energy while doing it.
Now, these are small studies. This is not the end of the discussion, not the be-all, end-all. But one possible lesson here, for me anyway, it could be partly about expectation. We expect to feel low energy in the winter, so we do. So maybe get out and embrace the winter.
So I have to say, the other day when we had amazing, gorgeous, big, fluffy snow globe kind of snowflakes, when I saw them out the window at work, it was all I could do not to start cartwheeling down the hall. Like, I love a good snowfall. So I might be in the minority, but I actually feel pretty energized in the winter.
Oh, you! I think a lot of people are able to embrace winter. The Birkebeiners this weekend, we'll see a lot of people get out and enjoy and be energized by winter. I can't honestly always capture that myself.
It can be tough. Those gray days when there's no snow, when it's just dirty, frozen stuff, that's a little
harder. That can wear thin. By the way, Monday we're going to ask what you love and hate about Wisconsin winters. So watch this space coming up on Monday here on Central Time.